First Peter chapter 2 and verses 7 and 8. Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense. They stumble, being disobedient to the word, to which they were also appointed. It was the American author Ernest Hemingway who once wrote, it was a kind of throwaway phrase, I think, these words. By guts, he says, I mean grace under pressure. Hemingway understood both what was meant by guts and pressure. We've recently been commemorating the 70th anniversary of the events of June the 6th, 1944, the landings at D-Day, on D-Day at the beaches in Normandy. On the morning of 6th of June 1944, Ernest Hemingway was in the seventh wave of American soldiers approaching Omaha Beach. He wrote about the horror of the American forces, finding that when they got there, that the beach at Omaha, the reality was that despite the bombing, the defenses were still very much intact. And on that day, he saw guts and grace under pressure, as men did not run away or back down, but took up the task of taking the beach. He wrote these words after seeing what he saw on June the 6th. Slowly, laboriously, as though they were Atlas carrying the world on their shoulders, men were climbing. They were not firing, they were just moving slowly, like a tired pack train at the end of the day, going the other way from home. Now, there are times in life when we are called to face up to real, tough challenges. It may not be the challenge of landing on the beaches of Normandy in the teeth of severe and violent defense. But nevertheless, we all face experiences in life where the challenge to run away, the challenge to back down, the challenge to effectively keep our heads down instead of standing tall and responding to that challenge, those temptations are very great. And Christians are not exempt from this kind of challenge. The phrase, grace under pressure, in many ways sums up what Peter is driving at in this first epistle. The Christians who he wrote to initially, the very first readers of this document, were experiencing profound challenges. They were the difficulties and the horrors, not of D-Day, but of state-sanctioned Roman persecution. So, for example, you might like to turn back to chapter 1, you get a flavor of this immediately as Peter begins his letter. He refers to the Christians as being pilgrims of the dispersion, or the NIV describes them as being strangers in the world, scattered as a result of persecution. This dispersion wasn't that somehow the Christian leaders had got together and decided that, well, there are these regions, and you get them listed there in the ancient world, Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. It wasn't as if they kind of thought, now we need to embark on some sort of evangelistic strategy, sending some of you here and some of you there, and great plans were laid down over a long period of time, and people were sent out in a sort of blaze of encouragement on some sort of great missionary venture. No, these people were in these regions because they had literally had to run there for their lives with their families. Such was the intensity of the hostile persecution that is breaking out round about the time that Peter writes to Christians. And so when you get to chapter 6, you get a kind of, verse 6 in chapter 1, you get a further flavor of this, where Peter writes, "Of in this you greatly rejoice, though now, in the present, for a little while, if need be, You may have been grieved by various trials. There were many, many trials that these Christians were facing. And in verse 7, the next verse, he kind of gives us a sense of the nature of these trials. He speaks about these trials being an experience, though like something being tested by fire. A harsh trial, a refining experience, but nevertheless a profoundly painful thing. Well, the difficulties that the early Christians faced at the hands of the Roman Empire, particularly later on with the evil Roman Emperor Nero and others like him, are well documented. Tacitus, who was a Roman senator and historian, in his writings records these awful events taking place under the reign of Nero. Then Nero, in order to avert this report from himself — this was the issue, the suggestion there had been a terrible fire in Rome and that Nero was somehow guilty of it, and Tacitus says to direct attention away from himself, he caused those called Christians by the common people to be accused and exceedingly tormented. And he goes on to speak about how he sought to stir up antagonism towards Christians and to blame them for the terrible fire which had taken place. Tacitus writes of this group, of how he stirred up hatred towards them by all mankind, until eventually Nero set about taking their lives, accompanied with much mockery. And terrible, terrible ways were devised of not only persecuting and killing these Christians, but they were ways not only to see them murdered, but also totally and completely humiliated. So as Peter writes of a fiery trial, as he writes of Christians on the run, scattered, or using the word that we have here in verse 1 of chapter 1, dispersed, these are experiences which are very, very real. Now, as I was reading this and thinking about it, and thinking earlier about that quotation from Hemingway, looking at those young men advancing up the beaches of Omaha and other beaches in Normandy on the 6th of June 1944, I don't know if you remember, but I concluded that little quotation with this phrase, "going the other way from home." It's ironic words, aren't they? But they're full of pathos. Here were these young men, thousands of miles away from the cities and towns and villages in America, and advancing, yes, into occupied France, but in reality going the other way from home. Peter, as he writes here, to Christians experiencing great trial, great difficulty, great hostility, in chapter 1, verse 9, says something quite remarkable. In many ways, the opposite of what Hemingway had said. "Receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls." Far from going the other way from home, these Christians, as they experienced this persecution and difficulty, were each day moving nearer and nearer towards the ultimate destiny of the Christian believer. Now, as Peter writes this letter, his concern is that they might display grace under pressure. You know, when things are going wrong in your life, or when you're under a lot of pressure, or maybe you go into work tomorrow morning and the first person you speak to just chews your head off, and you think, "What did I say? All I said was good morning." And then someone says, "You haven't heard." And they tell you what has happened to this person over the weekend. They've been under such great pressure that suddenly the niceties of normal behavior are kind of suspended, and it becomes understandable because of pressure. Now, Peter, as he writes here, is writing to appeal to Christians to say that despite the pressure which you're under, you are still called to live the life that Christ has called you to. There is to be no releasing, no relaxing at all of the high calling and the high standards that he has called you to. They were to live well continually, despite the fiery trial and despite the difficulties that were coming their way. Why was this? Well, there are several reasons which are given, it seems, in these chapters. One of the great reasons is that we're told in chapter 1 and verse 16, very simply, they are to be holy as God is holy. One of the great reasons that the Christian is always called to live a godly, Christ-like life in the world, regardless of what may be going on in our own lives or around us in terms of difficulty and challenge, is that there is to be a consistency between the way we think and talk and live and our Heavenly Father. God is holy. You belong to Him. And as a result of that, you too are to be holy. Christ is, ultimately, we've been told in this passage, in chapter 2, verse 4, the living stone. He's the great object of everything, isn't he, in the church of Jesus Christ. But we are called to be, he tells us in verse 5, living stones. That is, we are to be in close fellowship with him, and just as he is holy, we too are to be holy like him. Another reason why we're called to live distinctive lives of the highest standard, regardless of the provocation, we're told in chapter 1 and verse 17, is that we mustn't forget that God judges. You call on a Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work. So says Peter, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear. Now the judgment that the Christian will receive is different to the judgment that the person who is not a Christian will receive. The person who is not a Christian faces the awful prospect of God's eternal judgment and his wrath. That is a severe and a dangerous and a terrible thing. But the Christian will face judgment, but it's different. It's the reminder that it's judgment in the context of a relationship between a child and a parent. That's why Peter is careful to stress in verse 17 that we call on a Father who judges. But nevertheless, he does. He knows our lives. He knows our thoughts. He sees the way in which we behave. So he goes on in that 17th verse to say, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear. So despite the opposition, despite the provocation, because God is holy, because he does judge, we are to live lives of the highest standard. There's another reason as well, very briefly, that is that we are to live well by God's standards because this is what the gospel produces. Look at chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. Knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver or gold, from your aimless conduct received by tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. The gospel has called you to a new life. And it is a new life, isn't it? It's wonderful. It's a new life hallmarked not just by a sense of peace and a sense of knowing that we've been brought into the truth and the fellowship of God's people, but it is also a life that is to be hallmarked by the transforming work of the Spirit now that we belong to Jesus Christ. So despite great difficulty, despite great hostility, we are ever to live lives distinct from those around us. But in the particular words which I want us to look at this evening, verses 7 and 8, we are given perhaps another powerful reason, the 7 and 8 of chapter 2, another powerful reason why we must live well in the face of persecution, difficulty and provocation. Now verses 7 and 8 have within them a contrast. And it's true actually that in times of persecution, often society throws up divisions. Times of difficulty. Nero, as we saw, sought to bring attention and turn the attitude of society against Christians. We see it going on in the Middle East at the moment, in the Islamic world, with the tensions between the Shiites and the Sunni Muslims. Divisions break out. Now this passage, verses 7 and 8, speak of a great division. In fact, it's the ultimate division. It's the division between the believer and the unbeliever. And central to this division are these wonderful words defining the difference between the Christian and the person who's not yet a Christian. Verse 7. Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious. And that phrase is followed by that single word, but, pointing us to the reality, by implication, that to those who do not believe, Jesus Christ is not precious. It's a major division, isn't it? And I wonder tonight for you whether what your attitude is ultimately and your response ultimately to Jesus Christ is. Is he interesting? I hope he is. Is he compelling? Well, he certainly should be. But verse 7 goes much further. It speaks about him being precious, valued. You have precious things in your life, don't you? We all do. Perhaps the most precious thing you have is your health, your physical health, your mental health. And maybe the older you get, the more concerned you get about it. And you find yourself, as the necessary frailties of life come upon you through age, aware of things you took for granted when you were a young girl or a young man, you now value highly. It's precious to you. It's more than just interesting, your health, isn't it? It's precious. And that's the kind of sense that Peter is writing here about Jesus Christ. He is essential, he's telling us. And he is glorious and precious. But of course, by implication, we have been told here that the person who is not a Christian simply does not consider Jesus Christ in this way. That's why I think it's an important question to ask yourself tonight. What is my response to Jesus Christ? How do I see him? Do I see him as being precious, vital, and essential, and wonderful? Well, Peter, as he writes here, speaks about building off this argument of this division between the Christian who sees Christ as precious and the unbeliever whose response is to see Christ ultimately as a challenge. That's why in verse 7 and 8, the second part of verse 7 and into verse 8 speaks about the stone which the builders rejected. That's a reference to Jesus, has in fact become the chief cornerstone. Christ is considered of no value ultimately, or no importance. He's just a stone to be discarded. Has in the final analysis, and will in the final analysis, be revealed as the most vital stone. Similarly, verse 8 speaks about Christ becoming a stone of stumbling and a rock of offence. Now this is such a serious situation, and Peter is so aware of this, remembering now the context, that these Christians are called repeatedly now to live lives of an exemplary standard, shining out the hope and reality of the gospel amongst people who hate them, people who despise them, people who are wanting to destroy and murder them and who mock them on a regular basis. But who are these people? Well, he refers them in this epistle to them as being pagans. That is, they are people who had numerous ideas about God and the universe and thought they had all spiritual matters sewn up. But the reality is, they are people who are stumbling over the very thing that is vital and essential for every single human being. If there is to be any sense of hope between us and God, that is Jesus Christ. And so when you look at verse 12, he goes on to say a curious thing and a challenging thing that links in with the previous arguments that he's been laying down about why we should live good lives, even amongst people who despise us and persecute us. Verse 12. Having your conduct honourable among the Gentiles or the pagans, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they observe glorify God in the day of his visitation. That's Peter's concern. He wants them to live good lives among the pagans. Have your conduct honourable, he says, among the Gentiles. Despite the fact that they're doing terrible things to you, despite the fact that they're pouring persecution upon you, you are to live your lives, your conduct is to be honourable. Now this is a great challenge, of course. We can't begin to feel the force of Peter's words to these first Christians. Imagine families which have been split apart by persecution. This document was written initially to people who would have been in a context where they knew people firsthand who had lost their lives simply because they were seeking to live out their Christian life. There's an edge to all of this that if we're not careful, we can lose. And this is hugely challenging, though, even for us as well. That as a Christian, there are times when the going is hard, difficult. Maybe you've got family members who pull your leg a little bit about the fact that on a beautiful, sunny Sunday evening, where did you go? The idea that you spent the evening in church? Well, it's mind-blowing to them. And is that just that subtle little dig, that little sense of bewilderment and amusement and increasingly more a marginalizing of you because of your convictions as a Christian? Sometimes it can be much more than that, though, can't it? Sometimes it can be quite direct and increasingly direct hostility towards you as a Christian. Well, Peter is showing us in this letter, we are called to respond in a way that is exemplary, that our conduct is honourable, our speech is of the highest possible standard, and our hearts are driven by the purest motives. Why? Well, it seems that within this letter, ever, his eye is on the reality of those who are doing this, are those who one day must ultimately appear before the judgment seat of Jesus Christ. Now, it's interesting that when you sort of pull this together, you realize, of course, what Peter is doing in this letter is what is repeatedly done throughout Scripture. He is appealing for godly, holy living amongst God's people. He's laying down several arguments. They're like layers. But I think it is the argument, really, in verse 7 and 8 of chapter 2 that is most compelling. For here he presents to us the reality of what ultimately should drive the Christian to be willing to sacrifice, to keep our mouths shut when we feel like arguing back, to keep pressing on forwards when we feel like running away, to keep on keeping on living as Christ has called us to live. What is the great motivation for that? And it's found not in a rule book. It's found not in a sense of tradition. It's found not in a sense of a desire to be understood by our contemporary context. Instead, it is to be driven by a sheer wonder and appreciation of the preciousness of Jesus Christ. In other words, the thing that is to drive you and me as we seek to live holy and godly lives is just being thrilled by who Christ is and what he has done. Do you know, I have to be honest, I think often we've failed in this area of seeking to challenge one another and build one another up in this matter of living holy and godly lives by approaching it so often from the kind of rule book angle or the traditional angle. This is how Christians have done it in the past. This is how we should do it now. Instead of doing what Peter says here, we should be so thrilled by who Christ is that becomes the driving energy to sacrifice and live for him. And of course, this verse throws up huge questions. Why is Christ precious? The text answers it for us, doesn't it? He's the capstone of the faith. There you see it for yourself in verse 7, as Peter quotes there gloriously from the Old Testament. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Cornerstone was vital. I'm not a builder, and Nigel put me right at the end, I'm sure, if I got this wrong. But if you look at a bridge, an arch, a stone arch, capstone, central stone in the middle, there taking the pressure, vital. It has to be right. It had to be cut perfectly. It had to be engineered perfectly and constructed perfectly. If there's an uneven load on that stone, when the pressure comes in, the weight comes in, the stone would crack and break and the bridge would collapse huge care was placed in building the cornerstone or the capstone. And here Peter is saying, this stone which the builders rejected, and kind of it's a reference to how folks under the old covenant, and the news when Christ had come, and you see it in the Gospels so often, don't you? The Pharisees getting so angry, and the Sadducees, and they regard him as an imposter, they regard Christ as an imposter to the point where ultimately they want to murder him. And they trash him and they throw him out. They have him crucified on Calvary. And they walk away on that occasion probably congratulating themselves that they've put this impostor and blasphemer to death. Well, says Peter, quoting here, he says, that's the stone which the builders rejected. But what's the reality? He's become the chief cornerstone. He's the center of everything. This is who Christ is. He's the capstone of the faith. Christianity absolutely stands and falls on the person of Jesus Christ. One of the great tragedies of so much of the kind of religious culture which we've had in Wales over the decades is that people have been drawn together sometimes by everything but Christ. Drawn together by the social life of the church, the choirs, the benefits, the religious experience, and all of these things. But Christ is absent. You can't have that. What you have there is a counterfeiting of authentic biblical Christianity. Christ is everything. You're a Christian tonight. The security that you have before God. We mention in prayer those wonderful words from Hebrews 4. We can approach the throne of grace with boldness. Why is that? It's because of Jesus Christ. Knowing that you might be here tonight, you've had a dreadful day of utter hypocrisy and failure as a Christian. Nevertheless, you can approach that throne of grace with boldness to find grace to help you in your time of need. Why? Because of your great high priest, Jesus Christ. If it were not so, you would have no hope at all. The list is endless. Christ is the reason for our peace with God. He's the reason for our delight in God. All of these things are because of Jesus Christ. The apostles were so clear on this. Again and again you find people like Paul announcing, we don't preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. Why? They got it. They'd understood it. They'd realized Christ is everything. He's the cornerstone. He's the foundation. He's the very heart of everything. Who are we? Well, we are but your servants for Jesus' sake. John the Baptist got it right, didn't he? Who am I? I'm just a voice crying in the wilderness. And you remember that day when his disciples turned up and they said, John, you've got a terrible problem. There's this chap called Jesus from Nazareth and he's becoming more popular than you are. And what did John do? He rejoiced. And he spoke those wonderful words about Christ. He must increase. I must decrease. Why? He knew who he was. The preciousness of Christ. This is not merely a theological observation. No, as Peter is writing here, he's writing to people who are suffering and dying. They're not just being challenged in their theological ideas. They're being challenged physically to the point of death. But from these truths comes great and profound practical results in the lives of God's people. Everything rests on Jesus Christ. He is to be central, not only to our understanding of the faith, but also central to our Christian experience. He's the one, of course, who delivers us from the power of sin. There again, these wonderful words in verse 6 of chapter 2. Behold, it lay in Zion, a chief cornerstone, elect, precious. And listen to this. He who believes in him will by no means be put to shame. Christ is the one who delivers us from the shame that comes as a result of sin. He sets us free from the power of sin. Before sin came into the world, there was no sense of shame. What did Adam and Eve do the moment they sinned? Well, Genesis 2:25 tells us that they knew they were naked. That initially, though they were naked, they felt no shame. But when they sinned, the first thing they do when sin has come in is to hide. The Lord God called to the man, where are you? He answered, I heard you in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. And God said, who told you you were naked? That's what sin does. It creates shame and guilt. Well, the wonderful news is that if our faith is in Jesus Christ, we will never be put to shame. That's what the scriptures say. The power of sin is broken. That's why we sang that tremendous hymn, isn't it? In Eden, sad indeed that day, my countless blessings fell away. That's the mess. That's the reason for shame. That's the reason for guilt. That's the reason for regret and fear before God. My crown fell in disgrace. But then comes the gospel response. But on victorious Calvary, that crown was won again for me. Now what is my life? Is it disgrace? No. Is it shame? No. My life shall all be praise. That's what the gospel does. That's what Jesus Christ does. He takes guilty, shameful men and women and sets us free and turns our lives into lives of praise. He is precious. And we are to feel this upon our souls, aren't we? He is the one who transforms us. There's those remarkable words in verse 9. Now, it is a tremendous list, isn't it? Chosen generation, royal priesthood, holy nation, his own special people, called out of darkness into his marvelous light. You were once not a people, but are now the people of God. You once had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. This is the transforming work of Jesus Christ in your life. The amazing news is, now you're a member of his family, the family of God. You're a recipient of mercy, not just in the day when you believe, but every single moment of your life since then. And that is how it will ever be. And this, friends, are some of the reasons why he is precious. There is so much more we could say about this, but time has gone. But here is, I think, ultimately the great motivation for godly, holy Christian living. It is not the fear of being out of step with the ideas of others around you in the Christian community. It's not a desire simply to echo and resonate the way Christians have walked in the past by the voice of tradition. But it is to be sheer delight in Jesus Christ and the knowledge that this is what he has called us to do. Do you know, I think ultimately when we face the greatest tests, and of course the reality is in our country, the things which were going on, when Peter was writing this letter for the first time, these things are a long way away by God's grace at the moment from our experience. We have a man who worships with us on a Sunday evening. And he's an elder in the Chinese underground church. He's been arrested. And the reality there in China today is very, very different from this country. We have tremendous freedoms. But you know as well as I do that there are times in your life and times in mine when the pressure is on and the difficulties come. The challenge is ever the same. You are to be holy as God is holy. This is the calling you have received. Your conduct is to be honourable amongst those who despise you. And what is to motivate you? It's the preciousness of Jesus Christ. Grow in your understanding above everything of who Christ is and what he has done for you. The effect in your living will be profound. And what a joyful thing this is.